Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast, which this week might well be called either Movie Spider or Book Giant Brazilian Centipede, but which is generally known as Book Spider, a podcast which might in its format roughly be described as Book of the Week, although we're doing another slight variation from that today, and which strives to view the rotting corpse of literate culture in every stage of its long decay. Today we're talking about, just generally about David Cronenberg, the films of David Cronenberg, but particularly about David Cronenberg Clinical Trials, a book of critical essays by Violet Luca about Cronenberg's work. Cronenberg, of course, being one of the most visually and conceptually intriguing filmmakers of all time, also one of the most creatively provocative and transgressive. Clinical Trials offers a comprehensive overview of Cronenberg's career using concepts from Jungian psychoanalysis of the shadow and the animus slash anima slash animum, and then aligns a series of Cronenberg films into the four stages of psychoanalysis. I asked us to look at Clinical Trials as an inlet to discussing The Shrouds, the most recent film by Cronenberg, which I watched shortly after it came out and was bemused and baffled by and thought that would be a really good thing to discuss with a couple of other smart dudes. So I do have a couple of smart dudes with me here today. My fellow Book Spider hosts, Chris Malmberg.
Hello.
And Patrick Barney.
What's up?
So The Shrouds, the most recent and perhaps last film by Cronenberg, it would be, I think, an appropriate endpoint, although careers so rarely end on such an appropriate note. But
he is 82, though.
He is 82. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, my dad is 82 and he's still writing concept albums about cars. So you never know. The Shrouds, the most recent film by Cronenberg, which follows the story of Karsh Relic, who has been in a state of mourning for an undetermined period of time. I think at some point there's a reference to 6 years, but it's not clear if that's exactly the case. He's been in mourning following the death of his wife, Becca. He has constructed shrouds, which allow him to view the real-time decomposition of Becca's body. And when those shrouds are vandalized, he goes through a series of strange plot movements, before fleeing with a new lover. And The Shrouds, when I saw it, reminded me of another Cronenberg film, Naked Lunch, which is a surreal portrait of the author William Burroughs in the period following his accidental killing of his wife Joan, and during the writing of the book Naked Lunch, during which he confronts his repressed homosexuality in the form of grotesque insects and a complicated espionage plot. Now, that's a relatively brief overview. You know, normally at the beginning of the pod, we'll do an extended synopsis of whatever book we are discussing. I think in the case of both The Shrouds, excuse me, The Shrouds and Naked Lunch, both of those are very dense, twisty plot-oriented movies in which the experience of plot while watching the film is kind of both forefront and ultimately perhaps irrelevant, which is something I want to talk about more later. Like I already mentioned, Clinical Trials is, you know, here as kind of the book to make this a Book Spider episode, right? But I have to admit, I do find myself somewhat more compelled by talking about the films than the book. But we'll get into all that. But, you know, again, the core approach here is to think about the relationship between The Shrouds and Naked Lunch as a way of hopefully elucidating both of those films, which are among the most obscure of the body of work of a filmmaker who has made a fair amount of obscure work. All that being said, the starting point I wanted to jump off from, you know, the I had sent Chris and Patrick a few questions ahead of time, and as I was writing those, I thought, wow, my own evaluations of the quality of all these works are pretty buried in these questions. So to kind of establish a baseline, we don't always do this, but I just wanted to start by getting a sense for where the two of you stand, right? So Chris, how did you feel about clinical trials?
I really liked the voice. Violet Luca is the writer. In part one, in which we kind of go through, we do a gloss on, I believe, all of the movies that are covered in the rest of the book. And I thought that was valuable. And I just, again, really actually liked reading these kind of summaries with insights from the author. When we got into part two, and even before that, Animus, Anima, Animum, and the Self, and that's where we're kind of jumping into the kind of real structure of the book, where specific movies are picked out for fitting into particular slices of Jungian philosophy and psychoanalysis. And I got to admit, I pretty much most of that washed over me, and I didn't really, other than a few insights here and there, I didn't really feel compelled by a large argument that may have been made about, you know, this being a particularly useful lens for applying to Cronenberg. And I thought the pairings were kind of convenient / haphazard. And there were some nice insights here and there, but I found the first third of the book interesting, and then the last two thirds, not so much.
Patrick, how did you feel about clinical trials?
Movie's good, book bad.
Yeah.
I'll just say before you go on that, you know, my reactions were pretty similar to Chris's. Some valuable insights with a lot of, like, specifically the Jungian framework being mostly garbage. I also did want to say that I thought you brought up Revolution of the Ordinary in your questions, and I thought a lot about, like, that, like, this is the exact thing I don't think critics should be doing, which is, you know, trying to interpret works according to a framework.
Yeah. So just for more background on that, I had this later in the question sequence, but I almost feel like to some extent we might be kind of dealing with the book in a pro forma way and moving then to the films, which are the really fun thing to think and talk about. Right. But a few years ago for this podcast, we read a book called Revolution of the Ordinary by Toril Moy. And in that work, Moy essentially argues, man, it's been so long, and it is complicated academic philosophical argumentation, so this is going to be just the most grotesque of oversimplifications. But Moy argues, basically, as I recall, she's against the approaching of texts through the kind of default theory lens that much academic literary criticism reaches for, based on the idea that almost always has a sort of reducing, homogenizing effect that does not really approach the unique qualities of the text. And I agree with that conclusion rather heartily, even though some of the reasoning she uses to get there, I remember being a little bit odd. And this, I think, is clinical trials, I think, is a really good argument in favor of that, right? Because Luca clearly has watched and thought about these films and understands them, I think, as well as most fans of Cronenberg. But then, yeah, the whole kind of imperative to fit it into an analytical framework.
Right.
If this were just presented as synopses and thematic outlines of every Cronenberg film, I think that would be perfectly interesting and useful as a guide.
Right, exactly.
And And having to skim past all the stuff about the animum and how the anima, you know, the anima is a sexist concept, so now we have the animum. What if we just didn't have any of that stuff? I mean, and maybe a different, it might be that a different analytical framework could be more revelatory, right? I mean, part of the problem, Lucas says pretty directly that she's doing something kind of strange in the pairing because Cronenberg is a very staunch materialist. And to the extent that he even like cut a scene with a ghost out of a script that he was adapting. And Jung, of course, is not a materialist. And boy, maybe the two of you have other thoughts about this. Most of what I've encountered of Jung's work and Jung's thinking and Jung's concepts and influence, it seems kind of just like nice sounding bullshit to me. I don't have an enormous amount of, I don't really have any respect for Jung as, I mean, sometimes he can give you a way to think about a subjective experience that provides an interesting framework for it. And on occasion that has happened to me, but you know, he's always seemed to me fundamentally like a bullshit artist who is taken seriously as a commentator on lived reality in a way that he mostly doesn't really deserve to be. So just the fact that they, and again, I say that as someone who like has found a certain amount of like personal gratification in considering this or that narrow band of my subjective experience through a Jungian concept, but generally as filtered through a friend who was going through analysis and not having to kind of, you know, put up with the whole sort of mainstream of just kind of ideas that like all these kind of quasi-religious ideas that are sort of treated as living in this sort of gray space between this liminal space between philosophy and psychology and science, when in fact they're almost more like just straight mysticism, you know? So
I think Jung, Freud, pretty much any practitioner of psychoanalysis proper. Now, I don't want you to confuse this with talk therapy, specifically psychoanalysis, which is a Freudian, Jungian, and their ilk type of thing. It's all a ton of garbage. It is, as you said, complete bullshit. And I was actually kind of upset in the book when the author Luca seemed to imply that Freud was a friend to women, when, you know, in actual cases, he suggested to them that they have sex with their abusers. Not only are their ideas bullshit, you know, Freud's a bad dude. And Jung was a racist, misogynist dude too. So, yeah, they suck.
I like Jung. I'm
wrong answer.
I wouldn't call myself a Jungian because I think that, like, I think that sort of class of Jung stan is really hard to, I don't know, it's really hard to defend. I wonder, honestly, if this book is more like an introduction to Cronenberg for Jungian folks. And read that way, it kind of, I think, is, you know, it feels a bit like it's the specific narrow audience of that is pretty fascinating. But if you are a fan of Cronenberg already and you like have seen his, you know, movies and have really spent time with him, I don't know what the value of this book is. But I'll come out and say I think that Jung is very interesting because he turned rational framework to a study of the subjective, and I think that is potentially interesting with Cronenberg. because Cronenberg is very similar. I think that his subjects are very different. I think that his affect is entirely different. I think that his final conclusions are very anti-spiritual in most cases, which again is very distinct from Jung, but the muscle is similar. The muscle that they're applying is very similar in that they're both very interested in the subjective, and their primary tool for analyzing it is extremely rationalist, to the point where there's almost this kind of like jarring when you're watching Cronenberg. It can feel a bit like, because he is kind of, for being a very challenging director, he's also kind of a sedate director. And there's something about that conflict, or the kind of contrast between how strange the things that are happening are and how rationally they're being portrayed or explored. And I think that's interesting, but I don't think that there's enough of an overlap there to really justify applying this framework.
I think that the thing you just said, Chris, is probably actually like a more interesting and articulate explanation of the relationship of those two people, of Cronenberg and Jung, than anything in this book. Just so congrats on that.
We don't have to go down this rabbit hole, but I was wondering, Chris, if you had an example of Jung's rationalism.
Alex, I'm going to plead the fifth. I did not come prepared to talk about Jung, but like, basically Jung and Freud are trying to create rational frameworks for translating from entirely subjective and, you know, I think that we would say today potentially meaningless forms of personal experience to broader patterns in human behavior. And they're using rational frameworks to do that. I mean, that is what dream analysis is basically applying rational frameworks to subjective, the most subjective experiences possible, in that there is nothing empirical to measure or to evaluate the subjective experience against. And so that tension is, I think, always there in Freud and Jungian analysis.
I will say that I am pretty ignorant of Jung's specific thought and his specific method, so I won't really say much about that, but I'll definitely say that Freud, if his method is broadly rationalist, like we can use dreams to think about the human psyche, his procedures are anti-rationalist. At least that's my take. For example, you know, when trying to interpret dreams, he'll say something like, well, this element here in your dream stands for this other element that is the opposite of it. And there's nothing inherently rational in that connection. He does this all the time. And I actually wanted to comment, use that to kind of comment on one thing that Lucas says. But all I'm saying is that Freud, if it is rational to think that that dreams are a way to think about the human psychology, which I think it probably is, he employed highly irrational procedures in that greater rational method, which I think should be noted.
I think that you and I are going to circle each other perpetually on this, because you believe that rationalism is possible and I don't. And you're talking about it like you're evaluating subjectively the rationality of other people, and basically like,
but the, your position doesn't make any sense then. Like if you're saying he has, if he's rational,
no, a rational framework is just a repeatable, like formula. Like that's all that it is. It doesn't need to be, it doesn't need to feel rational. Like math and higher level math is rational. It doesn't feel rational. Like, but that's why I think that we would circle each other forever, Patrick. All I meant to say, as far as a rational framework goes, is it is a repeatable, externalizable means by which a particular, in this case, therapy can be repeated by different people for different people and still retain its integrity over time. And that's something that an entirely subjective thing can't do. It's only rationalized in such that in the sense that it is a comprehensive framework that persists after Freud is dead, after Jung is dead. And that's what I mean.
All right. I don't know why we would use the term rational for that, but okay, whatever. We can move on then.
I mean, I think that you're both more versed in these things than I am, I think, so maybe I shouldn't talk. But like, when I think about what I know or understand of Freud, I mean, what he's essentially doing, and Chris, maybe this is part of what you mean by rational, he's taking the framework and he's taking the kind of tone and framework and the kind of illusion of the rigor of hard sciences and applying that to a bunch of made up bullshit, which is kind of asserted as though it were objective fact, like the id, the ego, and the superego.
Yeah, that's exactly what he did.
Those are not things that can be proven to exist in the same manner that it can be proven that a water molecule has this and that ratio of
right.
oxygen and whatever. I don't know my chemistry well enough to carry the example out here, right? But like,
that's very well said, Hans. I think that that's maybe a better way of explaining it.
And I think you actually both, if thinking about it from that standpoint, I think you actually kind of both secretly agree. It's just that you have different levels of regard for rationalism.
Right, right, right.
So, but I mean, I don't even know that, like, when we say rationalism, I don't even know if we mean dictionary definition rationalism. We mean more the kind of the way of a kind of quasi-scientific way of thinking and describing, which is actually being used to express what are essentially fictions and metaphors. And that mixture, I think, is actually kind of pernicious, right? Because it asserts, it blurs realms of knowing in ways that I think can have pernicious effects. But that's, again, not really, maybe not relevant to Cronenberg. I was thinking while we were talking about, you know, two filmmakers that we've talked about on the podcast that I used to think of in the same breath when I was young, David Lynch and David Cronenberg, right? And why did I think of David Lynch and David Cronenberg in the same breath? I assume probably because they're both like quasi-genre filmmakers that make you feel smart when you're 25, right? And I don't mean that. That sounds demeaning, and I still have enormous respect and adoration for both of those artists, but I do think that, like, you know, that's the relationship a lot of people have to them at a certain phase in their lives. But they're in many ways, they're actually very, very, very distinct from each other. And one of those distinctions is that Lynch, I think, is almost always... and maybe you guys can complicate this, right? But Lynch is almost always trying to describe a subjective state in film. And Cronenberg is making a very clinical, objective presentation of something that might be absurd or bizarre or, like, in some ways reflect a character's subjectivity. But it's like Lynch kind of... Lynch uses very mostly, I think, relatively simple filmmaking techniques to, in a very abstract and free associative way, capture subjectivity. And Cronenberg, I think, it's more a question of a character's subjectivity sort of invading the physical, rational world, right? Something like, you know, The Brood, you just very literally have these, like, representations of the psychology of this woman that are... And I think that's one way in which Naked Lunch is very unusual in his body of work, because it is actually... The mugwumps don't exist in kind of the literal world, even of the film, right? The mugwumps don't exist. The typewriter, the insectile typewriters with talking anuses, they don't exist. They are, I think, understood to be hallucinations, essentially, right? And he's on bug powder, and he's hallucinating all these bizarre things as a way of, you know, dealing with guilt and repressed homosexuality. And that's very different from something like The Fly, where Brundle is literally turning into a giant fly, and everybody understands that in the same objective way. Or even something like, I think Videodrome is an interesting example, where it initially seems to be, I mean, there are a bunch of hallucinations in Videodrome, but you do end up having this very clinical, rational, scientific explanation for it, right? They are induced by a signal, it's a representation of a subjective state, but it actually ends up being directly connected to science, right? And I think that's, you know, I when I watched The Shrouds, kind of bringing it back to the question that spurred the whole podcast, right? Like, how do The Shrouds and Naked Lunch, how are they distinct together from other Cronenberg? I think the ways in which the kind of the if I'm understanding it correctly, The Shrouds ends in something that's either a hallucination or a dream state or a kind of like transition into true subjectivity. And that's very unusual. And well, when I say true subjectivity, so the last image in The Shrouds, he's on the plane with Su Min. And she takes on, he's on the plane with Su Min, and she takes on the stigmata of Becca, right? The scars and the amputations, and begins kind of, I took careful note of it, I think talks as Becca for a moment, and then talks as Su Min, but seems sighted. And I guess you could just say that's a dream, right? It just ends in a dream sequence. But it's a dream that is expressing the subjective thematic truth of the film in a way that is removed from what's physically happening within the world of the film, which is roughly what Naked Lunch does.
Okay. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I got it.
Is that true? Is that right? Am I full of shit? I don't know. I'm kind of tossing that out for evaluation. You know.
I think the comparison is apt. Yeah. It seems like at the end of both Naked Lunch and The Shrouds, we are in the subjective point of view of the protagonist, and like that's the film kind of fades out with that final subjective view, and we're not exactly sure. Like, we assume, I guess, in Naked Lunch that he's still hallucinating, like when he gets into, what's the name of the other country? Anexia.
Yeah.
Well,
I was going to phrase this as a question, but should I just lay out all the parallels that I've come to see between Naked Lunch and The Shrouds?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have no objection.
It's a little bit self-centered, right? Because I'm supposed to be facilitating a discussion, but I'm going to monologue instead, which is my greatest flaw as a podcast host. But
I'm going to unzip my pants.
So I don't have this. I don't have this written out in front of me. So I'm going
to. I suffer in silence, but whatever. I guess we don't have to care about me.
I don't have this written out in front of me, so I'm just going to shoot. And it might, I think, hopefully it'll come out okay. But Naked Lunch and The Shrouds are both partly about mourning for a dead wife who reemerges as a doppelganger. In the case of Naked Lunch, it's Joan, who, you know, in Inner Zone reemerges as another Joan. In the case of The Shrouds, it's Becca, who actually kind of reemerges as a doppelganger in several ways, right? She has a twin sister who is a distinct character, but who, you know, we can't get away from the fact that they look identical because they're played by the same person. And in fact, the AI assistant turns herself into a doppelganger briefly by taking on the kind of scars of Becca as a way of teasing Karsh. And at the very end of the movie, his new lover also takes on aspects of Becca. So they're both about an extended, like in some ways, both movies are not fully, but partly about grief for a dead spouse who reemerges as a doppelganger. They both are consumed with complicated espionage plots that end up perhaps being irrelevant. They both end with a journey. In the case of Naked Lunch, the journey into Anexia. In the case of The Shrouds, the journey to the journey to Hungary. They both end with a journey in which the spouse doppelganger undergoes some kind of final transformation. In the case of Naked Lunch, it's, you know, shooting the Joan doppelganger, which I think, among other things, is a way of truly accepting and mourning her death. In the case of The Shrouds, it's Su Min becoming a version of Becca, which is a way of... many ways you can interpret that, but I think is, among other things, a way of understanding the... everybody becomes Becca in the sense that everyone we love will die and we have to deal with that, live with that, right? And to the extent
our
that...
our baggage never goes away.
Our baggage never goes away, right? And both Naked Lunch and The Shrouds, because Naked Lunch is a long hallucination and because The Shrouds, a high percentage of it is dreams, including some of the most compelling scenes, both of those are, I think, spend more time documenting subjectivity than something like, you know, The Fly, which does have a dream state, a dream sequence in it, but is primarily about a... literal, visceral, real-world transformation. Or something like, you know, Eastern Promises or A History of Violence, which are just more, much more straightforward films. Again, yeah. They both have dream sequences, but they are both...
they're realist
films. They're both straightforward. They're realist films in a way that neither of these are. So that's I think that... that's it. That's my big monologue about why Naked Lunch and The Shrouds are the same. Maybe I didn't need a podcast for
this. No, right?
But I don't know. Are those fair or am I?
No, I think that's a really great baseline to set because I was thinking of Crimes of the Future, the more recent one, which is batshit crazy. And I love it. I love that movie, actually. I find it to be a very warm, strangely like sweet movie. But there's no, I don't think any passage in that is presented as a hallucination, as insane as the events of that movie are. They are all Kafka, metamorphosis, you know, they're all like, this is actually happening. This is not a metaphor for anything. It's just actually happening. And, so I think that's right. And I, you know, Videodrome, I think, does sort of straddle that line. And, but I think that it's a really...
Existence seems closer to the Naked Lunch.
Well, that one's very interesting because it's subjective reality replacing reality because they are in a kind of simulation. That's an interesting one too. That's a good point, Patrick.
It's very much like Videodrome, I think, where like a technological apparatus becomes a framework to kind of move into a sort of dream state world. It's a hybrid in that way. I think it's a very good, it's a good counterexample, right? Maybe there's more subjectivity and hallucination and kind of unreality in Cronenberg than I'm giving credit for, because you can, you know, the fact that there's, I mean, I'm saying that there's a scientific framework for how it's happening in Videodrome and Existence. I guess man takes drugs and hallucinates is in some sense a scientific framework as well, right? It's not like Lynch, where, you know, something like, Lost Highway, where there is no schema in which to fit it. It is just true surreality, true subjectivity.
Yeah, that's the only thing I was thinking of. Like, Existence seems like another film where, you know, Videodrome, Existence, Naked Lunch, The Shrouds seem like they go pretty deep into subjectivity. Shivers is pretty straightforward non-subjectivity. God, I love Shivers. It's so great. Fucking sex zombies. It's so good. I really dig Shivers. I haven't seen when I was listening. Yeah, it's good. It's worth seeing. When I was listening to the book, I was a little bit bummed that you picked this because like I knew that some things in some of the movies that of Cronenberg's I haven't seen yet would be given away. Like, I haven't seen Crimes of the Future yet, but like, you know, it's like, Cronenberg and Bergman are my two filmmakers whose all of whose films I actively want to see. And you know, it's just hard with kids and whatnot. You don't always get around to it. And before you know it, it's like, oh shit, it's been 3 years since Crimes of the Future came out and I still haven't seen it yet. But, so I was kind of bummed. I didn't want everything to be given away, but Shivers isn't super real. Scanners isn't subjective.
Well, I think that there's,
so it seems like there are is Dead Ringers, how subjective is Dead Ringers?
If I remember right, I think Dead Ringers is an interesting one because it, I'd have to go back to it to be sure. It's been a little while, but I think that it is definitely about two people losing their minds, but I believe that I don't think that the film externalizes or literalizes their delusions for the most part, right? I think we just see them behaving in, in insane manners, but we don't kind of take on their point of view the way that we would in Naked Lunch. But that might be, it's certainly not as visually, you know, outré as Naked Lunch or Existence. We're definitely not living in that kind of bizarre version of their world. There's probably a certain amount, I guess Spider actually, people tend to forget Spider, but I guess Spider, much of Spider actually is, it's totally, totally dismantling my.
He does movies in that are both realist and he does other movies that are non-realist. So it's like, he just kind of has and it's like when you look at a history of violence and Eastern Promises, it does seem to me that he's still kind of exploring the relationship between body and identity. So like in A History of Violence, when Tim Stahl or Tom Stahl goes back to Philadelphia, he immediately takes on that Philly accent. So that's like how, that's like the another way of thinking about the relationship between physicality and identity. It's just there aren't exploding heads like in Scanners or talking anuses like in Naked Lunch, you know. But it's still like, so I think that's neat. I think that's neat how Cronenberg can do that. And it's like, I also think it's cool because, like, I like his exploding head movies. They're great. I also like his realist movies. I also think those are great. And it's weird how successful Cronenberg can be at both extremes. So I think that's a positive of his work.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely, there's some deep part of my soul that just loves Existens, Videodrome, Naked Lunch. There's a way that I adore those in kind of not even a...
They're great.
And there's a way I think that they are like in my heart forever, that something like Eastern Promises, or even, you know, the slightly weirder later stuff like Cosmopolis isn't, right? Like the gooey bizarre 80s Cronenberg just is my thing in a very deep way. But I don't at all write off or dismiss the realist stuff or the later stuff, and I've kept up with it and enjoyed it, you know. I guess that's not the most rigorous analytical framework here, but
I probably enjoy the realist stuff as much as the gooey 80s head explosion stuff because of my man crush on Viggo Mortensen.
He's pretty tasty.
So I want to come back to the relationship between The Shrouds and Naked Lunch, because I think one of the things that I'd had in mind, the idea that they're kind of uniquely subjective in Cronenberg's body of work, that maybe doesn't stand up to scrutiny, right? I do think that they're both about, well, I still think that they're both about mourning a partner. I mean, a wife, well, you know, I guess I don't have to use, you know, squishy language. They're both about mourning a wife. They both have the kind of complicated espionage plots that may or may not matter. They both end on a journey with the kind of doppelganger of the lost spouse. But I wanted to think a bit more about, you know, in The Shrouds, there's the component of grief and the way that it's kind of made as an act of grief and the way that the character deals with grief. And then there's the component of the espionage plot, right? The, oh, well, you know, the Russians are trying to use the GraveTech graveyards as nodes in a surveillance network. Oh, well, but maybe it's the Chinese. Oh, but actually, you know, there's the kind of, especially in the third quarter of the film, you get this sort of increasingly complex play of developments and counter-developments and one character offering revelations that the next character completely undermines. How much does all that stuff matter, and how do we integrate the grief aspect and the international spy aspect?
Is the craziness of the international spy stuff in both films a measure of how much grief the characters are feeling subjectively?
Because there's a level of paranoia that sort of saturates both films that seems to be in response to something, right? So like there is something driving Karsh and Bill to create or hallucinate or really in Karsh's case, because he's so credulous a lot of the time. He's an incredibly credulous person. He's just basically told things and he just believes it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Yeah. Maury tells him a load of bullshit and he's just like, oh, yeah, I think that could be real.
He's got ketchup spread on his finger stumps and he's like, or whatever it is. But
That kind of makes him likable in a way that he's a little naive.
I wonder if that's actually, just this is an aside, I wonder if that's maybe a little bit of Cronenberg. Like, I know obviously Karsh is, his style to look like Cronenberg. Cassell, the actor, he's got his hair up and gray and he's kind of arch and looking, but he's very... he's very zen, very cerebral. And I wonder if there's a kind of naivete slash credulousness that you know, Cronenberg is externalizing from himself. It just seems like such a distinctive thing. Like
making fun of himself.
Yeah, I don't know. But in any case, it feels like the paranoia does need to be in response to something, right? If we're kind of piggybacking their subjective experience and seeing the world like sort of refracted through them, then these wild, incredibly unlikely stories, there must be some reason that they have found themselves spinning them up and occupying them and playing them out or following them. And I think that it makes sense, Patrick, for that to be something that's a response to grief, like, you know, being unhinged from reality, looking for meaning, I think is a really big driver for paranoia. Basically something that robs your world of meaning, like the death of your wife. You know, I think a pretty interesting, compelling response to that is someone who is basically projecting meaning onto meaninglessness, onto the noise of the random, and looking for a reason for, you know, bone spurs to be appearing on your wife's corpse as she decomposes, which is such a strange, like, it's the most strange, like someone becoming fixated on, you know, their lawn, you know, they're like the old neighbor that I think we've all had, who's had the perfectly landscaped, you know, backyard, and they cut their grass in such a way that the grass is swept in a pattern, and becoming fixated on specific blades of grass that are like pointing in strange ways. That is, I think, not too far different from, if we zoom way in, like way in on my wife's decomposing skull, we can see that there's little bone bumps. What are these fucking bone bumps? And it's just such a strange premise. And so, yeah, I think that, like, something has to be either that's who he is, he's, like, that fixated on stuff, or that fixation is being generated by grief, by pain. And I think you're right, though, Patrick. I think for me those are measures of grief. In Naked Lunch, I think the paranoia is also a reflection of things about Bill's self that he, you know, his homosexuality that he hasn't dealt with.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I think with the shrouds, well, my instinct is to say all of that turmoil, all of the turmoil of the vandalism of the graveyard and the kind of back and forth with Maury and all the other things around that, those are ultimately things to be discarded rather than solved, right? And that's kind of the revelation at the end of the movie. Instead, like, because we end on, I was going back through the notes that I was taking, and I don't think that I got this the first time because it's just, there's just so much there for a first viewing, but we end on a note of true unknowability, right? Because Dr. Eckler is in his grave, maybe, but he just doesn't know if that's actually Eckler in the grave or if that's a artifact of some kind of, you know, if the body is literally in there or if it's a lie that the Shroud Cam is giving him for whatever reason.
Maury could be fucking with him.
Maury could be fucking with him. And he decides that, I mean, you know, he says, oh, well, there's no way to know, but there is a way to know that ultimately he opts not to pursue, right? Like, I mean, maybe, you know, there are like permit reasons why you can't get a front end loader and dig the thing up, but if he really cared, he could get in there with a shovel, you know. It's not truly unknowable. He chooses to perceive it as unknowable, which is a way of finally leaving behind, I think, the the ways in which his jealousy and his obsession are forms of grief, and it's like he cuts the Gordian knot in a way, you know.
I like that he chooses not to know, because like we, you know, whenever Terry or Maury are speaking, because of their love of conspiracy, we really can't rely on anything they're saying, right? Like they're interested in conspiracy. Terry gets hot on it. Maury is either, you know, so unwound by his divorce that he is just inventing things, or he's like trolling Karsh because he's angry about his divorce. So they're not really super reliable characters. So whenever they're talking, we just don't know. So we don't know if Becca did have an affair with Eckler. We don't know really, like, there's nothing on paper that proves that Becca wasn't just seeing Eckler for treatment, right? And so, you know, him saying, well, I'm not going to find out at the end, is a way of saying, well, you know, even if she did have an affair, I can still move on with my life. And really, like, if you find Eckler in the grave, that's not definitive proof that they were having an affair. Really, I don't even know what it would be proof of. Like, who would have shot him and put him in there? You know, like, who knows?
The film reaches a point where nothing is proof of anything.
Right, exactly.
You, Chris, there's something that you said years and years ago that has always stuck with me. I've probably even mentioned it on this pod before, but the metaphor of the flashlight on the dark wall, right? Where, like, the further that you expand the range of what is seen, the more you identify the boundary with the unknown. Greater knowledge, greater insight actually at some point becomes a way of increasing the amount of unknowable.
Did you mention that, Chris, when we were talking about the lost art of skin? Because I remember, like, having a similar reaction to the lost art of skin in relation to the professor, like, you know, like, yeah, lost memory of skin, sorry, where our main character, our protagonist, just in the end has to choose to believe that the professor cared about him and was not a pedophile so that he can, like, move on, because there's no conclusive evidence one way or the other.
Yeah, I think I might have brought it up when we were talking about that book. I'll jump back real quick. I'm really happy to have watched these movies together more than watching them and reading the book, actually, because I don't know that I've gotten to the end of Naked Lunch. This is maybe the third time I've seen it. It's been a while.
I wonder why.
I don't think that I'd gotten to the end of Naked Lunch. And the order that I did this in was I read the book, I watched The Shrouds, and then I watched Naked Lunch, which I thought was kind of, I don't know. I did it that way because it felt perverse a little bit, but so I hadn't watched Naked Lunch and felt like that was a positive ending before, I don't think. Where, like, you know, if you took the Bill from the end of the movie and you put him in, you know, various situations earlier in the movie, would he behave the same way? Would he, you know, do the William Tell sequence with the, I think, goal of reenacting something, of reliving something, of pushing through whatever is trapping him by reliving it, but not, you know, running away from it. And similarly, The Shrouds, you know, Karsh in the, you know, you mentioned Hans, he could just pick up a shovel and dig up the grave and see. Karsh from, you know, the first half of the movie absolutely would. You wouldn't be able to sleep. He would obsess. And so we've reached a point where both are able to move on. But going to that, you know, flashlight metaphor, I think that, you know, Karsh's response is actually to grief and to, you know, all of the stressors in his life is to impose incredible amounts of control, which is very different from Bill. Karsh is, you know, creating this business. You mentioned in one of your questions, Hans, that the Tesla that he drives and the connections between Karsh and sort of the tech bro. There's always, I think, there's an inescapable odor of libertarian sort of making the world around you what you need it to be because you have the power to do so. And that's what makes humanness so powerful, so potent, is that, you know, a great man can rise up and do something like the shrouds and see his dead wife and be with her, you know, even after she's gone. And there's an amount of the way in which technology is the mediator, is the medium through which knowledge passes in the shrouds, is, I think, you know, I think it's one of the most interesting, I think it's the most interesting treatment on AI and what's happening to media that I've seen, for how it actually takes something that presents itself as an interface between you and the unreachable and gives you like perfect clarity. And they're talking about 4K and 8K, and they're just getting boners about how many fucking pixels they're going to get on their dead, you know, partners' bodies. But the fact is that all of this technology, you know, is, there's a way in which it basically creates a portal through which, you know, massive hallucination can occur and actually like distance from reality. And so, Karsh is sort of like, you know, being presented with an image of Eckler's body in his grave.
Right. Yeah. It's a positive thing. Definitely.
And him choosing not to engage with that, I think is, you know, my subjective reading on that is it's an extraordinarily healthy choice because Honey, you know, is another sort of like, this is the AI on his phone. I really, I have mixed feelings about the Honey sort of character, I guess, but all encompassing, I think that treatment of technology is so lucid and nuanced. It really blew me away because I think everyone is talking about this now, and most of how it's talked about is pretty banal and not very interesting. And I found that aspect of the shrouds to be incredible, very, very compelling and interesting to think about.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the treatment of like the social media of the grave, that concept is super apt to you know, how social media destroys us and how it kind of distances us from our humanity and you know, a unified sense of self, or a positive self-image, a positive a positive identity. Like it's like almost so on the nose. Like it is so on the nose, the social media of the grave. You know, equating our use of social media with death. But, you know, the developments in the story are also super cool because, like, you know, there's the idea that the shrouds might be used as, like, a way for Chinese surveillance applications and spying to, like, get a hold of everybody's information. So, yeah, I agree.
It's interesting, Chris, that you mention Honey in particular, because I, as we were in the moments before you kind of got onto that topic, I was thinking to myself, I think we've done a pretty good treatment of what I set out to cover here, and we've probably given this a good run. And then I realized that there was this whole thread that I hadn't really considered at all. And I think that's just a testament to what a, in some ways, a rich, odd, interesting, complicated text this is, you know? I think I had very mixed feelings about The Shrouds after the first time that I watched it, and having been through it again with a little bit better sense of where it was going to go, it's a very interesting, enjoyable film. You did say that you had mixed feelings about Honey. Do you mean that you had mixed feelings about how that device works in the movie?
Yeah, I think I'm trying to put my finger on it. I really found Honey compelling as its behavior became more strange. And then when the origin of that strange behavior, it's hinted that Maury is messing with Honey in the background, or has messed with Honey. Maybe because I was buying into this, not a singularity artificial intelligence awakening thing, but more Honey as a reflection of Karsh and like some kind of externalization, some kind of like, and I suppose this still can be true, but like AI, you know, is an incredibly hallucinatory, schizophrenic, unaccountable engine of deception. But it in that it is, you know, not unlike, I think, corresponding with a kind of a, I don't know, an ancient shaman or something, you know, something that is able to draw from countless disparate threads and is kind of responding in the moment with very little attaching itself to, or less attaching itself to, like continuous empirical reality. And so there's something about, you know, Honey, you know, especially sort of there's a way in which I think the movie is smart to complicate the dreams by having Honey actually like recreate them, in which either means that there's something that is outside of Karsh that is engineering those dreams, or that Karsh is projecting them, or that Honey is itself a hallucination in that moment. There's something that connects the internal reality and the external reality that is never really clarified there. And I really like that as a very interesting idea for what, you know, can be either problematic or very interesting or even therapeutic about an AI, because I was maybe bought in, and I've only seen it once at this point. I was buying into this idea as the AI, as Honey was kind of giving him shit, that there was something there because he is so controlled. He is so Karsh is, you know, especially it's interesting to cast Cassel in that role, because like Cassel is played in at least two other Cronenberg films, kind of crazy motherfuckers. In the Freud movie, what's it called? He plays Otto Gross, and he's, you know, like a lascivious hedonist, and then he plays the kind of shitty bonkers mafioso son in Eastern Promises. And here he's just like so controlled, you know, basically like he's presented with this vandalization of the cemetery, and his wife is buried there, and he's obviously like torn. He's been bent all out of shape in grief, but even bent all out of shape, he handles it by, you know, by speaking rationally through everything. And there's something about that that feels like it needs some kind of like external vector for, you know, a little bit of like craziness. And I guess I was sort of reading Honey as that, but it felt like it got too complicated with Honey not having any, not being given enough room for that. And ultimately, the guy Pierce character, being potentially responsible for causing that. So I don't know if that makes sense. I spoke a little bit longer about that than I intended.
What I wanted to think about this, just maybe to clarify issues. So on the one hand, Maury being like the behind the Honey avatar does have good thematic value in that if the movie is trying to comment about AI and reality in any way, it's reasonable to point out that people think that AI is like an autonomous intelligence that can provide neutral answers, when in reality, AIs function off of basic commands that, you know, their programmers make it function with, which is why, you know, Elon Musk's AI, I think it's Grok, you know, started calling itself Mecha Hitler, because he wanted to change it so that it didn't, you know, transmit the woke mind virus or whatever. You know, he's a nut. So AI is not an autonomous intelligence that provides neutral information, and the movie if Maury is in charge of it, the movie shows that. However, it doesn't quite make sense if Maury is programming Honey to project the subjective dreams or the dreams that Karsh has had, because how would Maury have access to that? So I think I'm agreeing with you, Chris, that there is some kind of tension there. Unless we're explaining it by saying that Karsh had a delusional or hallucinatory moment.
I guess that I just assumed that Maury knew that Becca had looked like that in the last months of her life, and that that was an image that would haunt.
Oh, that makes sense.
Okay.
Now, I will say, when I watched the movie the first time, I think that there's a moment there where when that happens, it does feel like his dreams are invading his waking life and he might be losing his mind a bit. But I would assume that that is, on reflection, a kind of just a manipulative decision by Maury, who knew his history well enough to guess that that would be an image that would in fact have the resonance that it does.
I think, Patrick, you kind of rescued Honey for me, because I think that I think that it is thematically really, really, it fits with this desire to observe everything and to be directly connected, you know, like only my phone can connect and see my wife, and there is no intermediary. And yet his, you know, personal assistant is a bundle of ones and zeros that's been programmed by a schizophrenic, who's deeply pissed off with him. So like, you know, it's a very, there is an incredible, there's a couple of moments in the movie, where I don't know, Hans, did you get this in your second time through? It seems like, I think that this is something that Cronenberg does. And I thought about, Inherent Vice too, with these movies, the kind of like concentric conspiracy theories, the lack of clarity, unresolved storylines, but you know, Videodrome I think does this as well. Existenz, but I feel like Karsh in particular, maybe because of his credulousness, I got the sense that if there was some kind of conspiracy, that he is the most naive person in the room and that everybody knows it somehow. Like everybody is just sort of like basically using him.
Yeah. Terry calls Mari the schmuck, but it may be Karsh.
Yeah, there's something about him that feels almost like he's been propped up. Like how is he this very successful person? You know, is he? He's not the biggest. He's not the biggest fish in the biggest, you know, ocean. He's a relatively large fish in a, you know, pretty good sized sea. But there are people like, I think, like Su Lin, who is Su Min. And her dying husband, who I get the sense are much more important, much more widely known. I don't know. There's something about Karsh's vulnerability where like he seems to be in control, but it also seems like he has no control at any point ever in the movie. That you know, I found pretty compelling. I don't remember what more I was going to say about that.
Well, I think that that's, in a weird way, I don't know if it's weird, but I don't think that's so different from the way that the idea of AI is used here, right? Because I think both those things make it actually a pretty interesting portrait of a particular historical moment. You know, like the way that AI exists as a concept for people right now, it does create this weird opening where, because nobody totally knows what the actual nature or capacity of quote unquote AI is at any given moment, right? Because the technology is both working on principles its creators don't understand and in a constant state of flux. It's a moment when you could give somebody, you could give somebody a thing that is just you, right? And say, oh, here is the AI I created to be your assistant. And it's kind of, I mean, 10 years from now, you won't be able to do that because we'll, you know, the technology will be in a different place. 10 years ago, you couldn't have done it because it would just be too obviously implausible that something like Honey could exist. But there's nothing Honey does that is in any way implausible until she's revealed to be Mori. And yet it's also perfectly plausible that could just be something controlled in real time by Mori, or, you know. So it's, I think, an artifact of a moment where we all have a kind of, like, we're all Karsh in a way, right? Because we all have this sort of great collective vulnerability that is tied to this, you know, approaching this mysterious thing with various levels of credulity that legitimately might be truly transformative or might be like one big bullshit or one big scam, you know, one big hunk of bullshit, or both somehow, right? Which is what it seems to be at the moment. But But I think that's it's very and that's happening also at a time when, you know, the world is run increasingly by people who are in certain narrow ways incredibly competent, who are wealthy and successful by a certain metric, but who are also who have very partial intelligences, right? Who are smart and dumb in these very strange blendings that are very difficult to kind of parse or judge. Not unlike Karsh.
I love that. And I love that. And I'll say, just because you it occurred to me, there's one other connection between these two movies, and that is a woman character is revealed to be a male character. I don't know if you mentioned that explicitly, Hans, but
I absolutely did not, and that's a great. I like that a lot.
Wait, who's the male character in The Shroud?
Maury. If Maury's behind Honey, then
it's not quite as literal as the Frau peeling her skin off, and underneath she's the guy from Jaws. But
right. Yeah. Okay, I get what you're saying.
We could probably talk for another hour about Cronenberg and about these two texts, and maybe even for another 30 seconds about Clinical Trials if I tried really, really hard. But I think that feels like a good stopping point. Chris, what's our next subject?
It's not Chris. It's me. I always follow you, Hans, and Chris always follows me. Okay, so I hate doing this. This is such a complex thing, and I hate doing it where I'm like, oh, I give you a pick, and this is, you know, it's something that I don't like doing it because I just want to be able to go straight forward with this kind of stuff, but I kind of have to like feel you guys out about this one. So one idea I had was to talk about maybe my favorite book by George Orwell, which is Homage to Catalonia. But it's nonfiction, and I don't really feel like technical or tech or craft discussions of nonfiction are as deep as fictional texts are. I don't know why that is, but I feel like it never gets off of the ground as well. So my primary goal with talking about Homage to Catalonia would be more like thinking about it in relation to the political climate now, because basically it's Orwell's personal account of fighting against fascism in the Spanish Civil War. And I think there are a lot of parallels that we could with that book and our current political climate. Now, Hans has repeatedly said he doesn't want to have a political discussion. But I thought, you know, we do this all the time where we compare a work to something that's going on now. So I thought maybe I could sneak it in there, but I just wanted to see if that sounded okay. And if it doesn't, I'll pick something else and that's fine. It's really like, is that a discussion you guys would be interested in having? Like, we could talk a little bit about craft, but really it seems like the main point would be to talk about how it's similar to or different from what's going on now.
Yeah, let's do it.
And it's totally fine.
I mean, I can give that a shot.
Yeah. Let's do it.
You're all right with that?
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay. I want to make sure you're really okay with that, Hans. I know that like it can be a bummer.
You're asking both of us, but you're really asking Hans. That's what
I'm really asking, Hans, because I feel like you, Chris, would
well,
be
no
would
more,
be more
no more
open
questions
to it.
About rationalism, fucking Patrick. I'm kidding, but no.
Well, my,
no,
my
no,
bad.
No.
I genuinely didn't understand what you were saying, and Hans helped me understand.
I don't know. I've already had two beers, so I guess I'm a little spicy, but
with Hans kind of laying it out for me, I do think we totally agree. Like, Freud and Jung are applying what they think is a rationalist framework to something, and what they're coming up with is garbage. Now, whether or not consciousness is a thing that can be rationally understood, I don't know. Like, I get what you're saying, that you don't think it is, and maybe it can't be. I don't know.
Yeah.
But if it can be, it can't
yeah.
buy it
and,
for
and
it.
I,
right,
and
exactly.
I,
exactly.
I don't know why I got so fired up about that, Patrick. So.
Well, I got fired up about it, too. So, it's all good, I think. Cool. Everything's great. We love
Reach
each other.
Reach over
and we want to hug.
Give me a pat on the bottom.
I would like to, but I can't. So, Homage to Catalonia is okay.
I mean, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I certainly would be happy to read Homage to Catalonia, right? I think when it's come up in the past, it's partly, I mean, I don't want to, you know, the book itself is something I would enjoy reading, I'm sure.
Okay.
I've always liked Orwell when I've encountered him in the past.
All right.
I don't know. Beyond that, I don't know. I might not have that much to say in the discussion. We'll see. I mean, or it might more be about Catalonia, right? I don't know, like, I like doing this because it's a refuge from all that.
Right, right. And that's why I'm asking. Like, if you... I can pick something else. I totally can pick something else. Or I could say, how about this? How about let's do Homage to Catalonia, and we'll start off talking about craft. And if it goes somewhere else naturally, we'll let it. But if not, it'll just be a craft discussion, and that's fine.
That sounds good. I like that.
All right. Good. Yeah, yeah.
I'd totally be down for that.
Okay, that's cool. Let's do it that way.
Very cool.
All right. Well, peace
all
out, guys.
Right. Well, thank you, listeners, for listening to our discussion on the films of Cronenberg, and briefly, incidentally, on the ostensible topic of the podcast, which was the book Clinical Trials by Violet Luca. Thank you, and join us in a couple weeks for Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell.